Okay, this week's parsha is Parshas Re'eh. The main idea of Re'eh, in the sense, is that the two paths which are placed in front of the people, one, I would say, is the lifestyle which is associated with idolatry, and the other is God. And there are a couple of details here that I'll just start out so that you should see the larger issues of the parsha, then we'll get into something more specific. Over here, the parsha begins, Re'eh anochi nosen lefnechem hayom bracha uklala. See, I place before you today blessing and a curse. It's a bracha, the blessing. Asher tishmu es mitzvos Hashem Elokeichem, asher anochi mitzveschem hayom. The blessing, when you listen to the commandments which I, God, command of you today. V'haklala im lo tishmu. And the curse, which is conditional, if you won't listen to it. And if you'll deviate, follow other gods, and so on. When the Jews are going to enter into the land of Israel, there's a risk that they are going to follow the practices of the other nations. And I think it's important for us to understand a little bit about this choice of God or idolatry, and then to see in the text itself how this is being manifest. One thing that we know, and now I'm basing myself on prophets when they're writing about the Jews who later on in history do embrace idolatry at times, more often than not, it was not a situation of the Jews totally leaving God. Rather, it was a situation of the Jews, aside from believing in God, of also using pagan practices. Really of a combination of both. I believe it was the prophet Isaiah, Yeshayahu, who says, for how long are you going to sit on the fence? For how long are you going to try to, you know, do both things? Or the Yiddish term is tansin sechasinas. How long are you going to dance in both weddings? I mean, you can't have it both ways. Either embracing God or idolatry. And that's one of the major attacks. And today, when we look, you know, into the past and say, you know, why is it that people would even have considered, would have entertained the possibility of idolatry? And it seems so strange to us. And again, we have difficulty with it. One thing that I'll say, and this is the beginning of the analysis, is that it tells us a little later on in the parasha of an interesting contrast. Don't follow the idols that exist on every mountain and every hill and under every tree. Rather, you should worship God in the place which I'll choose to have my spirit, Shechina, rest. Which means that the contrast over there...
Orthodoxy would be really easy for people to follow. I mean, things like the Arab, which is, I mean, it seems to me sort of smudging the...
Look, I'm cynical also, but that doesn't mean that the people, the Orthodox, they therefore must suffer as much as possible. There are certain things that you have to analyze, laws and intricacies of laws, and to see how things are to be applied properly. Which means that there, again, and now is not the time to have a whole analysis within law, but it's interesting because I know a lot of people that are not observant, and I'm not saying anything about you one way or the other, I know a lot of people that are not observant who are very upset that religious Jews should carry on Shabbos. I mean, they don't give a damn about driving themselves, but, you know, why are these people using an Erev? If they're going to be religious, let them do it the right way. And there is this sense of people maybe trying to make things a little bit easier. Each case has to be analyzed in and of itself, within its own parameters, what are the issues involved, and to be able to appreciate it properly. But let's leave that aside. Is there paganism within Orthodoxy? That would be interesting to find some cases. The main contrast that we just now witnessed between every mountain, every hill, every tree versus a centralized place really gives us the beginning of the understanding of what it was about paganism which was so attractive to people. Paganism was available. It was there. Let me turn the question around. Why is it that today there are certain people that will take drugs, and for that matter, very serious drugs, for that matter, drugs that are so serious that they can cause extremely great harm to a person's mind, if not body? Why do people do such things? Does that sound naive, or you're going to tell me? You're not going to sell me anything now, okay? What? Yeah, go ahead. Go for it. We're both from Brooklyn.
The stability they are driven to it. Due to the circumstances which came to be as children,
so the one
manifest into adulthood, where they're seeking comfort.
Good. People seek comfort.
So people just don't grow up and say, "Hey, that's what I want to do." Okay, they fall into.
Okay, good. People want comfort. People want something beyond the regular, something, if I'll really be elevated, I'll even call it transcendental. People want spirituality.
They want that instant gratification.
They want instant gratification. You said it. That's the term. The instant gratification. People want it, and they want it now. Meaning, if I would tell somebody who's seeking spirituality that I can get you some spirituality, you'll just have to invest a little bit of time. Like, the first 10 years, you'll have to study Bible and commentaries, and you're shaking your head. And the next 20 years, study the whole Talmud and all its commentaries. And then maybe the next 30 years, and now the 10 years to study the Kabbalistic writings and their commentaries. And by that time, I'm pretty sure I can guarantee you, like, really an ability of touching the transcendental. So how many people that can get signed up for the 50-year plan? Anybody? No hands, no volunteers over here? And by the way, I can assure you that this would work. But is that going? Are most people going to be able to say, "Yeah, that's a great idea. Let me get involved, because then I can get in touch with something spiritual." Versus the immediate gratification. Idolatry was immediate gratification. The fact that we see that, you know, whenever you want to connect, you can just build an idol. The fact that we see it's being described on every hill, on every mountain, under every tree. Once you understand that, then you see that this was something which was widespread. On every street corner, they were selling it. Okay, does that help anybody at all? They were selling it on the street corners. It was a quick high. It was a way of feeling something beyond the normal. And it was, that's the thing. The people that were doing it weren't people that rejected God. And it weren't people that rejected Torah. It was people that were looking for shortcuts, and therefore they were willing to combine something else with their, you know, okay, yeah, I'll be on the 50-year plan, but I'm going to take, you know, I'll take, the weekends are mine.
They were scared of commitment. It was an easy, accessible thing. They can come and go as they please, you know.
Correct.
So now, one of the reasons why.
Absolutely. So now, this week's parsha, we have Moshe giving a talk, one of his last talks. From the commentaries, it's not that clear where the talk begins and where the talk ends. It's possible that the talk starts over here and goes all the way on through at least chapter 28 or 29. Moshe is giving a long speech over here. Moshe is warning the people against idolatry. He's saying, "Stay with God. Don't embrace idolatry." Moshe over here says, "I'm putting in front of you a blessing and a curse." Later on, we see this blessing and the curse spelled out in another context. We see in chapter 30, which is most likely either the end of this speech or beginning of the next one, Moshe says, "Re'ei nasatif necha yom es ha'chayim ve'es ha'tov ve'es ha'moves ve'es ha'ra." The same form is used. See, right over here. See, I've placed before you a blessing and a curse. Here the verse says, "See, I've placed before you today life and good and death and bad." And then verse 19 it says, "I testify here today, Heidosi b'chem ayom es shemayim v'sa'aretz, by heaven and earth, ha'chayim v'hamavis, life and death, nasati lefnecha, I've put in front of you, ha'bracha v'haklala, the blessing and the curse, uv'charta b'chayim, and choose life, in order that you and your descendants be able to live. So something very interesting just now happened. We started out this week's portion where God says, I put in front of you a blessing and a curse. Blessing and a curse. What is this blessing and a curse? Well, the blessing and the curse is associated with good and bad. Or the ultimate good and bad, what's it associated with? With life and with death. And let me ask you a very simple question. If I put in front of somebody two choices, one is a blessing, one is a curse, who's going to choose the curse? Or more so, if I put in front of somebody a choice of life and death, who's going to choose death? I mean, it seems an absurdity. Why would anybody choose death when they have an opportunity to choose life? I mean, it almost sounds, you know, yeah, I'll have some death, please, you know? Like, what is it even thinking? I mean, is a Torah being given to people that are out of their minds, you know, unstable people that, you know, God said, okay, here's a choice over here, life or death. And God has said, and I'll give you a hint here, choose life. What's going on? Has man ever had this choice in front of them between life and death before? Yeah.
It's not life and death in true sense of the word. Life as in following men, death as in living as a secular, not as a legit, living and becoming assimilated.
I won't argue with the latter point of what you said, but when's the first time that man ever had in front of him a choice between life and death? Adam. And which did he choose? Hold it. How do you have a choice to have life and death? What do you see then? Well, there were two trees in Eden. What were the two trees?
Tree of life and death.
One was a tree of life. It doesn't say life and death. It's a chayim, tree of life. And the other one was a tree of knowledge. And what did God say will happen if you partake of the tree of knowledge? You'll bring death to the world. So, what did man go for? Give me the apple. Send it over. Man went for... No, but that's interesting. That means that right now, we're at the border, about to enter into the land of Israel. Context is important. And Moshe is saying, God puts in front of us, in every generation, in every life, in every situation, we have in front of us choices. Our choices are life and death. And for some reason, people keep choosing death. Meaning, if Adam, and I hope I don't disturb you with what I'm about to say, if you're into science fiction, then maybe you'll like this. I'm not personally, so it doesn't mean I don't like what I'm about to say, but I'll say it anyway. If Adam would have eaten from the tree of life, what would have happened to history? It would have been a little different, wouldn't it? I mean, it's possible that God created a world. We got 6 days. Adam on the sixth day eats from the tree of life. He has a nice Shabbos with God. He hangs out with God. They have a great Shabbos together. And that's the end of history. That's it. Which means the fact that, okay, could be that for some of us in the room today, that would have maybe had negative implications. But I'm saying that God could have created such a situation. Choose life. At the dawn of history, we seem to make a mistake. We don't choose life. You think it only happened then? It says that the day that you eat from this tree, death comes into the world. The world now is a completely different sort of situation. Do you know when the death was gotten rid of? The second time it was gotten rid of. You know when? Who remembers?
What was the question?
When death was a thing of the past. I speak about this. What? When they stood at Mount Sinai. When the Jews stood at Mount Sinai and accepted her and had the choice again. I want you to think this through a second now, because things seem to repeat themselves. We need to understand this in depth. What was the tree of life and what was the tree of knowledge? I got a letter around a year ago from a woman. Her brother was an intelligent man, a lawyer, and said, I cannot accept Judaism because Judaism says that it's bad to eat from the tree of knowledge. How can you have a religion that rejects knowledge? Okay? By the way, that was a great excuse. You know? Who knows? Good. It's good. Steve, can you poke a hole in that or no? Knowledge. Knowledge is good. Now let's think a second. According to Jewish tradition, what was the tree of life? I'll give you some of you guys a hint based on a verse in Proverbs. Eitz chayim hi lemachazikim ba. It is a tree of life to those who embrace it. What's a tree of life? Torah is a tree of life. Now, if Torah is a tree of life, what's the tree of knowledge? What's that knowledge? Again, Torah is certainly a type of knowledge, a type of wisdom, a type of thought. Judaism, let's be honest for a second. Say whatever else you want about Judaism. I don't believe that Judaism is obscurantist in form. I don't believe that it's anti-intellectual, that it's anti-knowledge, and that it says, no, don't use your brains. I mean, maybe certain religions could be accused of that, but I don't think that's a big thing against Judaism. Yeah?
Well,
It's sort of like the instant gratification thing that you're talking about.
Ah, you're getting there. You're with me. Good. But what is it exactly? What is this knowledge? Secular. Burn the universities. Listen to this guy. What is it? So I'll give you a hint. Yeah?
It's a knowledge of all things good and evil.
What kind of knowledge? Okay, it's all things. It's
understanding. It's realizing. Only what God knows is that all evil and love.
The next verse, when they leave the Garden of Eden, it says then that Adam knew his wife. And you all know that that's where they get the line that he knew her in the biblical sense. That's the term. That's where it comes from. But it's fascinating. He used the same word. Vayada ad adam eschava ishto. He knew his wife. That seems to tell, and that's the verse right after they get expelled from the garden. That seems to tell us that this knowledge thing is maybe not what you would have thought. This knowledge is experience. It's being together. Certain people learn by virtue of experience, and certain people learn by virtue of studying. It seems to be that in Garden of Eden we're told either experience or learning, choose one or the other. What's so bad about choosing experiences? Experiences could be great. Probably half of you are traveling now anyway, trying to collect as many experiences as possible. Yeah?
Well, you run the risk of bad experience.
You run the risk of a bad experience is A, but there's a second thing, which is much more insidious. Through your experience, now you'll come to understand things. And that understanding could very well be a tainted understanding. I mean, just for example, I mean, the easiest example when discussing this concept.
Adam was drawn into it. I mean, that was...
You're blaming the woman.
He was...
he said, by the way, he said that, not me.
He was drawn into it.
Go after him,
and he blamed man for it.
But both of them.
When the evil serpent
good.
With her, he was sleeping.
What's your name again?
David Ashkenazi.
David Ashkenazi. Listen to me. There was a wicked serpent whispering in her ear.
Right.
We all have wicked serpents whispering in our ear, telling us choose death instead of life. Do you hear that?
Yeah.
Meaning if we use our minds, there's no question, there's no problem. Choose. He was drawn into it. He's not to be blamed.
No, he's blamed.
He's blamed. But all of us are drawn into things. We're all experiences is something out there that we all want. But what's the big problem? What is so bad about going after experiences? What happens by experience? Let's use the example of wine tasting. Anybody here like fine wine? Well, what would happen if you try to introduce somebody to fine wine without telling them anything about it? Somebody, a novice who's not, just here, just taste this. What would happen?
They like it or they don't. I mean, it's really out there.
More often than not, if someone's never tasted it, has no idea how to drink wine, especially a dry wine, they're going to like, where's get over that kiddish stuff, you know? Like they'll say, this is wine. I mean, if it's a white wine, they'll say it tastes like dishwater, and if it's a... No, one second. I'm sorry I'm saying this. I know it's sacrilege. Believe me, my father raised me better than this. And I'm deeply sorry. I'm just trying to explain how certain people, when they just go straight for the experience, without understanding. On the other hand, if you give them a little bit of lecture before, take it into your mouth, put it under the tongue, put it under the palate, and so on, then people will be able to experience what it is. But experience needs a knowledge beforehand. If our whole world is jumping into experiences, that experience will cause us to see the world in a certain way. Just very briefly to see where I'm going with this and not to get stuck on the example, okay? If the Torah is telling us in terms of certain values, this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad, this is good but should be done in this context, this is bad and avoid it completely, and on the other hand, and then I can understand that, and then as I go into the world and I experience things based on these principles, everything is fine. If I do the alternative, if I jump in, and then I go back and look what it says, that, you know what, that's counterintuitive. Don't you see? If you experience first, then the whole Torah becomes counterintuitive. And let's be honest, that's the problem that this generation has. So many people are brought up not within the world of Torah, through the world of experiences. And then they say, well, no, the Torah doesn't seem to fit into my lifestyle, into my heart, into my head, into my worldview, my Weltanschauung. It's not there. Why? Because these people made a basic mistake. That was the mistake that Adam made. Once Adam made that mistake, death is going to come into the world. Yeah.
But then, by the same token, I mean, all of the lecturing on fine wines in the world won't help if you never actually taste it.
No, at some point you have to taste it. Agreed. Agreed, absolutely. Experience is good. And that's now, you got to a profound point. That's why the rabbis insisted that Adam was supposed to gain knowledge first, then God would have given, gain Torah knowledge, tree of life, then God would have given him on a silver platter the fruit from the tree of knowledge as well. But the problem was the order of the way that it took place. Once you switch the order around, that's when it becomes dangerous. That's the philosophical idea behind these two trees in the Garden of Eden. What happened? Now, death is in the world. Man now has experienced something, and it's very difficult sometimes to get an experience out of you, to try to change after a type of an experience, to get back to the point that you were before. But Judaism is possible. There's an idea of tshuva and repentance. And let's not, for a second, think that repentance is something you just like snap your fingers. Okay, listen, God, I'm sorry, let's move on now. Sometimes the effects of our actions are profound, and it takes a long time to work them out and to change. Adam sinned, the world was affected. When was death wiped out from the world again? When the Jews stood by Mount Sinai. Because Mount Sinai is the tree of life. It's the tree of life. The same thing is taking place. It's right in front of them now. Go for the tree of life. And what do? Moses is coming down 40 days. Watch the clock. 40 days, it's going to be there. Only 40 days, that's it. And what happens? How do they mess up? They go for the golden calf. But it don't... But don't you see?
That's not the only mistake that the Jews made.
Well, but that's a pretty good one. But that.
They haven't learned.
But it's
that's why we're still repenting for the Beit HaMikdash, that we can't come back. The first temple, 70 years, we paid our debt. Second temple, screwed up again.
David Ashkenazi. From Brooklyn. We grew up in the same neighborhood. A couple blocks from one another. Well, I'd never met him before. Before yesterday did. We took the same train. We constantly make mistakes, but that mistake by Har Sinai, that's what created the possibility for the temple to be destroyed, the first temple. Had that not happened, that spiritual power would not have been there. But think about it again. Moses is coming down from the mountain. It's going to be right there. But what do the people want instead? Instant gratification, golden calf. And by the way, I've never understood why there's no bar or disco called the Golden Calf. I think it's a gold mine.
I'm sure I can find you one.
Yeah? I never heard of one. Don't you think it's a great... Would you go to a place called the Golden Calf? Singing dance?
In a second.
Come on, guys. We can make some money. Look, I'd have to be a silent partner, but I think there's money to be made over here. I mean, what it was is, again, you think about it, and it tortures us. The fact that it's right there, but they couldn't even wait a couple more, it was even hours, immediate gratification. Now, Moshe, let's get back to context. Moshe is soon going to die. Moshe's going to die. He's standing there by the banks of the river. It's right there. And he tells the people, choose life. There's a blessing, there's a curse, there's a free choice. They're both right there for you. At the dawn of history, man made a mistake. At what could have been our finest hour in Mount Sinai, man makes a mistake. Now, all that's behind us. We're about to have a new opportunity. We're going to enter into this land and realize it's right there. Follow this path, blessing, good, life. It's great. Follow this path, and God says, this is what's going to happen. I'm laying it out for you. You look, the drug addict also knows the way it's going to end up. Does that help you any? It's there because it's so powerful. It's intoxicating. Because people want it and they want it now. And that's the issue right here. But I want to go a little bit deeper into the concept. I mean, God gives us two choices. Is the evil choice really the product of God? Meaning, does God give us evil? Does God create evil? Does God make evil right there? And you know, on the one hand, in terms of idolatry, the Zohar says that if a person worships a god other than God, you worship other gods, what's the big problem with that? Because when it really comes down to it, there's a reality in this world. There's a reality in the cosmos. What's that reality? God. God is the reality. I mean, in other classes, maybe next week, I don't know what yet, I'll teach you next week, maybe I'll come back to this idea. But if you think about it, God is infinite, the universe is finite. If you add infinite to finite, what's the sum total? Infinite, which means that all the only reality which exists is God. Everything else is this illusion which God allows us to live into. Which means if man embraces some other power other than God, they are embracing an illusion, a non-entity. It doesn't exist. And God says, that's what the Zohar says, when you embrace other gods, you therefore have embraced a lack of existence. Which means that in a sense, there's two choices. But one is real and one isn't real. One is a blessing and one is a curse. One is life and one is death. Reality or fantasy. And that's really what it comes down to. But a little bit deeper. Where does this choice come from? And realize, in Judaism, the idea of choice is something which we're passionate about. If man has no choice, then life becomes meaningless. If we're just robots programmed to do things, then life has no meaning. God gives us life, God gives us choice, and says, make the choice, but they're right there in front of you. Yeah?
I just wanted to say that what happens if someone's praying to God but it's through Islam?
Maimonides gave a very nice description of this in his Guide for the Perplexed. He said you have a palace and you have a king, and inside the palace is this chamber, and in the chamber is where the king sits on his throne. He said you have some people, everyone in the world wants to get to the palace. Because that's deep spirituality. Everybody wants to get there. Sometimes people are walking in the wrong direction. They're just going the wrong way. And what they think is spiritual is actually the opposite. He says some people are walking in the right direction. The Rambam, Maimonides, he says all monotheists are walking in the right direction. They're walking towards the palace. However, with a lack, there are people that will get into the palace and people that won't. There will be people that will get into the palace and get to the chamber. He goes, but there are very few who will be so connected they'll be able to get inside that inner chamber. But that is based upon not just monotheism, but really focusing in on it. So if you'll ask, you know, does God hear the prayers of Christians? Remember years ago, there was a priest who said that God does not hear the prayers of the Jews. I don't know if you remember such a thing. What? Yeah. Jews will say that God, one monotheistic God, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, we all believe, hopefully, it seems to be, in the same God. You know, and it is, I'm being very serious right now. It's very easy for me to discuss these issues with Jews or Christians, Muslims or Christians, because they basically believe that God exists, God gave the Torah to Moshe, and then God changed his mind at some point, and these other religions are supposed to be the fulfillment of Judaism. So you know what? They make it's, you know, there are how many Christians in the world right now?
A lot,
correct. And 100 million, 500 million, a billion, I don't know. They believe that God exists and gave the Torah to Moses at Sinai. You know the only people that don't believe it? Yeah, you know the answer. Yeah, the Jews. Yeah, I'm not so sure about it. I don't know, maybe someone else spoke, maybe it was just something they ate. But when you think about it, the Christians and the Muslims, like, they're onto it. Yeah, God exists and he gave the Torah to Moses at Sinai. That's fine. But it's just, you know.
They're praying for Jesus if they believe that.
Who, the Muslims? Oh, the Christians. It's another talk. It's another talk. But I do want to maybe go a little bit deeper over here. You know, There's a very popular question people ask: why do bad things happen? Why do bad things happen to good people? Where does bad come from? You know, how is it that a good God can put these choices in front of us and create bad? There's a saying which is in the Yalkut Shimoni. It's one of the Midrashim. The Yalkut says, "No evil descends from heaven. Nothing evil comes down from heaven. From heaven, everything is good." No evil from heaven. Now that's a little bit of a problem. How does God give us two choices if there's no evil coming from heaven? Like, how does this happen? So there's a verse in the Bible, the verse in Isaiah. We say a paraphrase of it almost every day in our prayers. It says that God says, I am God, there is no other. I, Yotzer Or Uvarei Choshech. God says, I form light, create darkness. Oseh Shalom, make peace. And how does that phrase end? Uvore sakol. You would ask a Christian, where does evil come from? What would they say? They say the original sin, and it's Satan. Or that serpent, right? That serpent. Satan. His name was Vinny, by the way. Yeah, he had his hair slicked back, had really sharp shoes there, and he was there, hey, you know, got some stuff for you. I got some stuff for you over here. Try it out. The illusionist, the magician. You know him. But back, how do we work this down? Christians had a very simple solution. Where does all evil come from? Comes from the devil. Devil's doing all the bad. Which is a little bit of a problem if you think about it. What's the problem? Well, if devil's doing all the problem, devil's doing all the evil, is God really monotheistic? Is God all powerful? If God is all powerful, then how is it possible that the devil's doing it? Make up your mind. Is God all powerful? Then can God stop it? I ask Christians this. Boy, would I have interesting conversations. Can God stop the devil?
Sure he can.
The Christian answer I got was, he's working on it. I'm serious about this. But if you begin to think about it, it becomes...
Anyway.
So again, David, you're telling me on the Jewish perspective. The Christian's perspective...
I don't believe in
that. Good. Baruch Hashem. The Christians were so bothered by this fact of where evil comes from. They say God does no evil. What do they do with this verse in Isaiah? I have no idea. But they say God does no evil. All evil, it comes from the devil. All evil comes from original sin, the devil, a fallen angel and all that. And God can't even stop him right now if he wanted to, but God is working on it. Maybe one day he'll be successful. So you're shaking your head. Okay, I agree with you. But what's the core of this idea? The word... I hope not. I really hope not. That's really what they ended up saying. That's really what their position is. I happen to agree with you, but most people who attack Christianity as not being monotheistic, they go on to the Trinity and say Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. On the other hand, you know, they can say that Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, the three are one, but this is a more profound problem, because over here it's dualism. Is God responsible? Is God responsible? If he is, then don't tell me anything about the devil. Nonetheless, when we look at this issue, we look at this verse, God says, I form light, I create darkness, I make peace, I create evil. Can somebody help me right now and tell me the difference between forming versus creating? What's the difference? What does it mean to form something versus to create something? Chaim. What is it? What are we drinking? Oh. What occasion is this? Baruch atah Adonai Mechalom Bori Pri Hagafen. What year? Beaujolais.
What?
It's a Beaujolais.
What?
It's good. Correct. Okay. Now listen carefully. Listen carefully. What is the difference in create versus to form? Who knows?
One you create new matter, and the other one you just form existing matter into something different.
Everybody hear this?
I didn't hear a word.
Everybody stay with me now. God says, I form light, but I create darkness. To form something means there is existing matter and you're making changes to that matter. To create something means something from nothing. When God says, I form light but I create darkness, I make peace but I create evil, that means that evil and darkness are created. What does it mean if they're created? It means they exist from someplace other than God. But there is nothing other than God. So let's think this through. The light in the world which exists is formed. That means the light in this world is somehow, and I don't know the right word for this, maybe you'll help me, refracted or bifracted or diffracted, or somehow coming from this supernal light which we call God. That is the light and the good in the world. Evil is created. That means evil is not part of God. Evil is something new.
It was formed from... I don't know, I must ask you a question.
Please. Yes.
The Yetzer Hara, that's something to do with evil that was created.
Yes. You're welcome. Yes.
I just wanted to say, Hashem, everything that he does is a balance. Okay? So from the light came the darkness. That's where the darkness, I think, was created.
Good. So you're quite, but let's go a little bit further, David. Absolutely. The darkness is a lack of light. It's something new. It's something which doesn't exist within God. When God creates the world, and now there's going to exist beings who are independent of God, at that moment, there will be darkness as well as light. What's the darkness? It's a lack of godliness. Why is there a lack of godliness? Because man is independent from God. We're given two choices. We're told, either go for the light or go for the darkness. It's completely your choice. But what, there's only one problem with going for the darkness. It's an illusion. It's not really there. And it's damn enticing. How could it be that God does this? I want to quote for you a passage in the Zohar, which explains this idea. This passage, I've used it in, there's one other class of mine when I go much more into the idea of good and evil. But it's worthwhile repeating in case any of you have not heard it. This idea of God creating, the mystics called it something called tzimtzum. Anybody ever hear the phrase tzimtzum? Tzimtzum means to hold back. God holds back all this light when he creates the world. God holds back all of his power when he creates the world. Because if God didn't hold up this power, then man would not be independent. Let me try to explain, and I'll start with the passage. The passage says that once upon a time there was a king. A great king, a wonderful king, a knowledgeable king, the best king in the world, greatest person in the world. This king had a son. And he educated his son, he taught his son, he inspired his son. He wanted nothing more than his son to follow in his path, in his footsteps. This king decided that he's going to have to send his son out of the palace. Why? Why can't he stay in the palace? Because in the palace, the king has full dominion. In the palace, one cannot go against the wishes of the king. The palace is not a real place. Let's get really quick over here. What's the Zohar telling us? Who's the king? God. Who's man? Okay, who's the son? Who's man? What's the palace? Heaven. In heaven, God is right there. We can't do anything but the will of God. We're there, it's pleasurable, it's great, our souls are connected with God, it's the most wonderful thing. All there is light. God says, he loves his son, he wants to give him a little bit of independence. If he gives him independence, now his life will take on meaning. He tells his son, I love you, go out of the palace, follow the rules that I've taught you, follow the ideas and ideals that you've learned, make me proud. He takes the son and sends him out. Now, for the son, is this a good thing or a bad thing that he's going out? This moment is called tzimtzum. Because at this moment, now bad can take place. In the reality, in the palace, there's no darkness. It's only light. There's no evil. God creates evil. What's evil? Evil is the result of creation of man. Not that man is evil, but there's a capacity of evil. There are two trees in the Garden of Eden. There's a chance for it, but we're told, make the choice. Reject the evil. The Zohar goes next step. It says, the king who loves his son goes over and commands this beautiful woman, I want you to dress up and try to seduce my son. Why does that put a smile on your face? What does the king want to happen? And don't say for the kid to get lucky. That's not the answer. What does the king want to happen? What does the king want? For the son to reject the advances of this woman. For the son to take upon all the things that he learned in theory back in the palace and now live by them, and now utilize them. But in the palace, that was impossible. Which means this kid, that night, right, he leaves the palace, he wanders into a bar, what's it called?
The golden calf.
There's a lot of smoke over there, some of it's even cigarettes. This guy's there, he's had a couple of drinks. There's music there in the background, you know, there's an energy there that he never felt before. And then there's this woman, she sort of walks into the room. That's not even a good term. She saunters into the room. She walks in and she catches his eye. And he says, whoa, I never felt anything like this in the palace. And I'm not going to go through all the details over here. But what does she want to happen? Well, if she's really a servant of the king, then she'll want what the king wants. If you really think about it deeply, I mean, this in the Jewish idea is the devil. The devil is a servant of the king. The king says, go set up a situation that somebody can have a possibility of rejecting the word of God. I mean, I'm going to embellish a little bit on what the Zohar says here. But let's just say that the kid ends up going that night with this woman. In the morning he wakes up and he looks, you know, the ray of light is coming in and it's shining on her. Now the makeup isn't there the way it was before. And he looks and he realizes, hold it, this isn't who I thought it was last night. This is a servant of the king. In the idea of the Zohar, there is no such thing as evil in and of itself. Evil is good dressed up in a seductive manner. What the Zohar ends up saying, it's a little happier ending to the story, the Zohar says that the kid rejects this woman. And then the king is able to give him all sorts of blessings and all sorts of rewards and all sorts of good. And the Zohar says, now who was it that brought the kid to be able to reach this high spiritual level? It was this woman. So it says, hold it. Is this woman, is she good or bad? Well, if we reject evil, if we refuse to embrace it, if we realize it's just good incognito, right, then that's the problem. But if we realize this, then that rejection allows us to get to higher levels. It says, love God with all your heart and all your soul. The rabbis say, with your good inclination, your evil inclination. Loving God with your evil inclination by rejecting it allows us to get to much higher levels than we ever could have gotten had we simply remained in heaven. What we see in this week's parasha, in a sense, it's the oldest story that we know. It's a story which took place in the Garden of Eden with two individuals, and one great-talking, slick-talking snake. The problem is that slick-talking snake follows every single person individually, collectively, follows us from place to place, from scene to scene, from palace to palace, from bar to bar. It's with us. What we have to know is that there is an antidote. The antidote is Torah. If one took an inoculation beforehand, they're all the more so empowered not to fall for its seductive advances. The Talmud says, if the Yetzirah, that's what this woman walked in once, if the Yetzirah is the same thing, the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, if the evil inclination gets a hold of you, so what does the Talmud say? Run into the study hall. Why? Home court advantage. You have a better meaning. If you run into the bar, you're not going to be as well, you know, have the same chances as your home court advantage. And by the way, the Kutzker Rebbe then says, and don't think you're going to win necessarily. I mean, you got them, and even when you're sitting in the base medrash, you want to study. The Yetzirah says, no, you don't have to study so much. You can do other things right now. But what this portion is about is the collective choice. The Jewish people as a whole now. At the dawn of history was Adam and Eve, two individuals. We stood at Mount Sinai. The nation was there. Parts of that nation made a wrong choice. They went for the immediate gratification. Moses is about to die. He's at the end of his life. He warns them now. He says, you have it right in front of you. Blessing, curse, life or death. You have the ability of keeping the words of the Torah, or you have the ability of being seduced and realize it's under every single tree, it's by every single hill, it's on every single mountain. Push it aside, be more sophisticated, be more intellectually rigorous. Realize that there is true spirituality, and it's in Jerusalem. Realize also that Jerusalem is surrounded by mountains. Sometimes, right? That's a saying also in Isaiah. Jerusalem is surrounded by mountains. But it's a very true statement. Jerusalem is this place of spiritual heights. And to get to Jerusalem, you have to climb a very, very hard... Maybe it's easy today. Today, you guys just... You know, you get in the Kahari, you get in the bus, you come to Jerusalem. But in the olden days, people understood this, that the last part, you know, you're coming down from any part of Israel, the last part, as you get to Jerusalem, you have these mountains to climb, any direction you go to. Great spiritual heights, the metaphor. Great spiritual heights, you have to climb. You have to work towards it. But it's there. Don't settle for the stuff available on the street corner. That's what Moshe is saying over here. Go to Jerusalem, climb that mountain, because when one doesn't go for the immediate gratification, the true spirituality which exists is something which is profound and something available to all of us.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a complete listing of our cassettes, see our web store at aish.com. For a free cassette catalog, email us at voices@aish.com or call toll-free in the U.S., 1-800-VOICES-3. Our main office is at 1 Western Wall Plaza, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.